the J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, another busy weekend in the top flight in Japan. Great to be back with you chatting about it.
Yeah, good to be back. It was a marathon, especially on Saturday, of games from like 6 a.m. all the way through till a 1 p.m. finish here. It was an absolute, a long one for me. I think next weekend's going to be the same, but enjoyed it all the same. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Busy weekend, but a good one. Yes, Saturday was definitely busy. You're right, Sam. An early kickoff in Sapporo, and then the day went all the way through to the late game at Ajinomoto Stadium between Tokyo and Gamba Osaka, with just the one game on Sunday. Joining us at the start of this week's episode is our regular Urawa Reds correspondent, Ryan Steele. Ryan, things are looking pretty decent at Saitama Stadium these days. Welcome back to the pod, and how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. As you said, things are looking pretty good. I don't think a lot of people probably anticipated us to have soared up the table as quickly as we have, but here we are.
Indeed, yeah. So the last time we spoke on the pod was back in the previews, I think, wasn't it, in early February, and then we got your thoughts as the season was going on about how much time Ricardo Rodriguez would get, this, that, and the other, after Reds made a little bit of a shaky start. But now it's 4 wins in your last 5, and the other game, I mean, everybody's losing to Fukuoka these days, so you are certainly no disgrace in that. But, before we get on to Saturday's win over Kobe, is there anything that you can see that a light switched on with, certain players, or Ricardo Rodriguez just seemed to be getting his message across a little bit clearer, perhaps, than earlier on in the season? Or what's been around? What's been behind the turnaround, do you think?
I think if you want to dissect it, we're going to need probably 3 different pod episodes to get through everything. But I think what Ricardo Rodriguez is trying to do is starting to connect with the players. You can see a bit more consistency in the performances, in the way they're playing through those performances. The signing of Kasper Juncker has been a bit of a revelation for the team up front. There are some fewer mistakes at the back as well. The midfield starting to gel as well. All the new players that have come in. I think it's just starting to come together at the right time.
All right, then. So, yeah, let's talk about Saturday at the Saitama Stadium, a game between two teams seemingly headed in opposite directions. Urawa hosting Kobe. Reds had won, of course, only one of their first 6, but they'd hauled themselves up from 13th to 8th at kickoff after winning 6 of their last 8, and indeed, 3 of their last 4. They entertained a consistently inconsistent Vissel, who had slipped from 3rd to 7th after winning just 1 of their last 6. And, I guess the pattern heading into this game, Sam, repeated itself here. An early chance for Kyogo Furuhashi in the 15th minute. But after that, early on in the second half, Tatsuya Tanaka gave Reds the lead. And from there, they never really looked back, did they?
No, I thought Reds were quite comfortable second half. I think, as you say, Kobe started maybe the better team. Had a bit more possession than Reds for, say, the first 20-25 minutes. But Reds then got themselves into the game at the end of that first half. And then scoring as early as they did in the second half, they just gained complete control of the game. I just thought they outpassed Kobe in the second half. They just controlled the ball. And Kobe were really disappointing, I thought. They made a few changes. Iniesta obviously got his first start in a rare visit to Saitama. I didn't think he was allowed there. And Lincoln started, and Lincoln didn't look that fit. So, they didn't really have the same dynamism that they maybe had at the start of the season, which was a fear I had when you bring in Iniesta back and you bring all these new players in. It seems to have disrupted their balance, but take nothing away from Reds, especially second half. I thought they were much the better team.
All right. So, Ryan, Tanaka has certainly made an impact in the last couple of weeks. He scored one in the win last week and set up the other two for Juncker. And this double act were at it again. Spoiler alert, Juncker scored the second goal with 5 minutes to go. So along those lines, with these two forwards coming in and hitting the ground running, if you like, we had a question from Kakichino 11 about some of the new signings. And they all do seem to have bedded in particularly well, haven't they? And it's basically within half a season, a lot of them have become regulars. Your Takahiro Akimoto's, your obviously your Kasper Junkers in recent weeks, Atsuki Ito, Tanaka, and of course the veteran Daigo Nishi. So they've all added something to the team, haven't they? Pretty quick time, and that must be something that's really pleasing for you to see.
Yeah, I think we should also mention Yoshio Koizumi. I know that wasn't an intentional thing, but he's been absolutely incredible in midfield. When he plays, when he's on form, he's just shining. But yeah, it's been nothing short of a miracle that the players that have come in have just kind of jumped in and landed on the ground running. It's been very, very reassuring for the rest of the season. Any other changes that happen, there's a bit more security in those changes should go well. They should be the right decision considering what's happened with the transfers in the last window. And yeah, it's just I don't want to get too too over enthusiastic about it, but it's been great to see those new players come in and be able to take positions in the starting lineup. Tatsuya Tanaka has kind of been sitting on the sidelines for a lot of this start to the season, but the last few games that he's come in, he's just been absolutely on fire. He also scored in the cup match that he assisted Juncker for two as well. Oh, was it a cup or was it? It was Kashiwa, so I can't remember whether it was league or cup. They've all become a bit of a blur at the moment. But yeah, it's been great to see, and yeah, it does make me look forward to seeing what other decisions come from the front office now, because it's not history repeating itself anymore, which is just such a delight.
Just the one signing that's maybe not made the same impact, and the one that maybe at the start of the season might have been thought to make the biggest impact, would be in Daiki Kaneko. Have you seen any reason why he hasn't necessarily hit the ground running at Reds, and do you think he will just eventually take a bit of time to get used to the way Rodriguez plays and maybe take over from UK Abe a little bit further down the line?
Yeah, I actually was asked this on Twitter, I think a week ago, basically the same question, and I think that's basically what it is. I think there's just been so many good players in that position, and there's just too many options. And with Yuki Abe as the captain as well, it's hard to push him out too often in favor of other players. Atsuki Ito has been very good, and Kai Shibato has been I wouldn't say as good, but he's been he's done what he's been asked to do for the most part. He hasn't made terrible mistakes or anything like that. So it's hard to push someone out of the team like that and disrupt the flow that they've had, and that's a very important thing, is maintaining that flow, maintaining that consistency, and letting the team kind of breathe and grow and adapt to things without too many disruptions. And I think that's why Kaneko has had to kind of sit out a bit more than I think a lot of people, myself included, would have expected at the start of the season. But at the moment it's kind of cup games are where he's going to get a bit more time to kind of stretch and get used to things and push for a position in the league.
Well, it's certainly good for the depth of the squad, Ryan. I mean, yeah, you've seen all these new players come in, hit the ground running for the most part, and, yeah, bed in fairly quickly. Well, yeah, you've still got, more to come by the sounds of it. And I would like to apologise, of course, to Yoshio Koizumi for not mentioning him earlier. I was looking at Akakichino 11's message while I was also looking at the starting 11 from Saturday, and there was one name missing, and that was Yoshio Koizumi. But, of course, he came on at halftime, and Yoshio will forgive us anyway because we've given him plenty of praise already so far this season. We did mention that, for the most part, Reds were quite comfortable in the second half, but just past the hour, Zion Suzuki was called into action to save from Andres Iniesta's shot, and then Tomoaki Makino blocked Douglas's follow-up. So, Ryan, there were a couple of questions also on Zion Suzuki, who has taken over between the sticks for Shusaku Nishikawa and in recent weeks. And I'm not sure I made a big enough deal of it at the time, Ryan, because obviously Nishikawa is... Well, whether he's your favourite goalkeeper or not, he is an absolute icon of the J-League. There's no question about that. And a larger-than-life personality and, been a great, obviously, servant for Reds and for the clubs he represented before he joined Urawa. But, a couple of questions on Zion. The first one came through from Johnny Nickel. Johnny asks, with Zion Suzuki looking good in his first three outings in J1, what do you think the future holds for Shusaku Nishikawa? So hold your fire for a second, Ryan, because there was another from Luke on a similar vein. Zion Suzuki, he's performed well since taking over the starting role. Whilst I'm sure Urawa viewed Zion as their long-term number one, I assume there were no plans for him to assume that role this season. And now that he is there, do Reds give him an extended chance to establish himself, or does that one bad game open the door for a Nishikawa return?
Yeah, both great questions. I think the statement that we weren't expecting Zion to be able to or be stepping up so early, I think that hits the nail on the head as well. It was very unexpected. I think signing Shiota as a backup, as a reserve goalkeeper, kind of suggested that the club wasn't expecting it either. It's a difficult question to answer. I'm a little bit on the fence in terms of who takes that first goalkeeper role. As you said, Shusaku Nishikawa is a legend of the league, not just of the club. He's played more than 500 now. He had his 500th not too long ago, and his performances, his titles, and just his career, the amount of call-ups he's also had for the national team, they speak volumes for the kind of goalkeeper he is, not just in reputation but also just capability. And for him to kind of be shunted out, it almost seemed a little unceremonious after making that milestone not long before. It was not a good performance. It was the FISPA game, I believe. Sam might be able to correct me, or yourself, Ben. Yeah, yeah. that was probably not the best match to have your milestone game. But I think he's taken it fairly well. And it's given Zion Suzuki a chance, and probably one that he wasn't expecting. And he's doing pretty well with it. I think Stuart Smith might be pretty happy with me saying that a goalkeeper is arguably the most nuanced position on the entire pitch. There's so much, let alone the individual performance, to take into account. You know, you've got to be able to command your line. You've got to be able to communicate really well. You've got so many different situations where you've got to do so many different things. And also, depending on the way the team plays, the kind of goalkeeper you need to be is radically different compared to someone in the outfield, which is only often minor tweaks to the way they're playing or where they're standing on the pitch. to ask Zion to step in is such a big ask for him and such a big deal, and he's doing very, very well with it. I don't think he's had consistent enough challenges throughout a 90-minute match to really say that he's that he's going to be the number one for the rest of the season. But I think for the time being, at least until, you know, he's called up to youth camp and is unavailable for selection, I think he's going to be the one that has that until Nishikawa is, I suppose, he's the only choice that the club has to bring back in. So, yeah, until then, Zion's the option to give him that experience. And, yeah, it seems like both goalkeepers are doing extremely well under the circumstances.
So do you think, Ryan, that Suzuki's under pressure, and a game similar to Nishikawa had against Fukuoka would lead to another change? Or at this point, do you think, Rodriguez is pot committed to Zion? He's made the change now and, reversing course after, well, he's looked very good and kept clean sheets in his first three league games. For me, he's got to keep faith in Suzuki from this point on, and he's got to be the number one now that he's taken the gloves. I don't know. Do you see it the same way, or do you think there is still a possibility for further switching during the season?
I think the nature in which he came in suggests that there isn't. How do I put it? I mean, it's such a weird situation in which it happened, because it almost seemed like it was just the one really poor game was the kind of, you know, straw that broke the camel's back for Shusaku Nishikawa starting. And that was what gave Ricardo Rodriguez the kind of need to make that change and bring Zion in. But he's also said that Zion has really impressed him in training and in matches. So I think he does have faith in him and is looking to bring him in as a I do think that he's going to be the main goalkeeper for this season. But I also think there's going to be moments where that can be tested. There's going to be those moments where Ricardo might need to say, and it won't be necessarily just from a match, but it could be times when they're all talking together and discussing what needs to be done in terms of development and all of those sorts of things, that they might say, all right, we'll step aside for these matches or whatever, or you've got your camp and you need to focus on that, so go over here. And in that time, if Nishikawa, becomes a previous version of himself, I suppose, because he hasn't been as good as he has in the past, then I think that might make it a bit difficult for Ricardo to suggest or to kind of take him out of the squad as soon as he's been brought back in. But yeah, it's going to be a very difficult thing for Zion to be taken out of the squad at this point, just because it seems like that, at least for the time being, is locked in. And he's a goalkeeper that they have an eye on the future with him. So I don't see why they would want to take him out at this point if they've given him so much faith to give him the starting position for the league.
All right. So another player that Luke asked about was Thomas Deng. Ryan, we might get Sam's thoughts on Deng first, if we could. Sam, obviously, Reds have settled on a back four with Makino and Iwanami, the centre backs. Luke wonders whether Deng can fight his way into the starting 11, and if so, where does he play? I guess it's three into two spots, and Iwanami and Makino seem established in the team at the moment. Deng might, if he hasn't been called up for Australia, if Australia are playing during the June international window, Deng might be able to play in the Levain Cup games, coincidentally also against Kobe. But what are you seeing for Deng this season, Sam, because his opportunities have obviously been limited to this point?
Yeah, well, he's missed most of this season so far through injury. Mm-hmm. So if he can get those games under his belt in the Louvain Cup when players are away on international duty, or maybe play a weaker team or a rotated team, then yeah, I think he should be pushing in for Iwaname's place. If I'm looking at all those players fit, I want Deng and Makino as my centre back pairing. I know he can also play right back and has played there a few times, but Nishi's there, and there's all the strong rumours about Sakai coming in as well, so I don't think he's going to be shifted out there. But I do think he's a better player than Iwaname. There were a few occasions earlier in the season, those games against Yokohama, those games against Kawasaki, where I think he was a little bit all over the place. So I think, even though they've all improved a lot in the last few games, I think he's probably the weak link. Initially, Makino gives more balance as well as the left-sided centre-back and Deng playing on the right. So I think that would be the way he would go, as long as Deng can get back up to the better levels that he was showing before his injury last season. But yeah, I think Iwaname, he's an okay and solid defender, but I think Deng will suit the Rodriguez way of playing a little bit more. I think he's better with his feet. So yeah, that's the way I would go. And then eventually, maybe a year or two down the line, Makino will then get phased out, probably either with a young player that's coming through the ranks, or they might look to make another signing there.
All right, so Ryan, obviously yourself and myself as Australians, we have a vested interest in how Thomas Deng's getting on at Red. So, yeah, do you see him fighting his way back into the starting 11 now that it appears he's worked his way back to full fitness?
I mean, as an Australian and as an RL Reds fan, I bloody well hope so. I mean, everything that Sam said, I completely agree with. I think he should take the place of Iwaname. I don't think Iwaname has been very good this season, despite having played most minutes out of any of the players in the team so far. I just don't think he's deserved that much game time. He's made a lot of mistakes throughout the season so far, and he's been guilty of some of the goals conceded as well, some of the really bad goals conceded. And the sooner Deng's fit, the sooner he should be starting over Iwaname. It's been, I think, difficult for Ricardo Rodriguez to find a spot for him. He's tried to put him on the bench in cup games and give him some game time, but there's been times where we've needed to chase a lead as well, chase the game from behind. So it's not really the best option to bring on a defensive player when you need to be scoring goals and you've got Kenyu Sugimoto on the pitch. So I think that's where it's been difficult to get game time since he's come back from injury, which hasn't really been that long either. As if he's not called up to the Socceroos for the next round of qualifying matches, then I think that's the time that he needs to be on the pitch getting minutes. If that's on the bench, from the bench, then he needs to come on at some point. It can't just be him in the squad just in case. He needs to be getting minutes. He needs to be getting some time in his legs so that he's able to be able to play a full 90 and he's able to take that starting spot. Because, if he and Makino are the two central defenders, that I could see that fixing a lot of the problems at the back, because it would just be a lot more secure and they'll be able to play the ball forward a lot easier as well, having a player that can play the ball. Iwanami's not bad, but he's no Deng.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, we've covered a lot of Reds players, both new arrivals and, players looking to push their way back into the starting 11. Perhaps we're saving the best till last, and I obviously teased it earlier that he scored the second goal in this game with 5 minutes to go. But, while Zion Suzuki's made a huge impact in the last three games between the sticks, at the other end of the pitch, Kasper Juncker, well, to say he's hit the ground running is a massive understatement. Another goal here, making it four in three league games since he has joined the club. And well, Ryan, you must just be pinching yourself here to have a player of this quality. He's straight into it, and he's looked absolutely terrific and such a nice guy. He didn't even celebrate this goal at first because he thought he was offside, but ultimately replays confirming that he was, although I didn't get a good angle on the DAZN highlight, so I'm still skeptical myself. But the goal was given anyway. And Kasper Juncker, you must, as I say, you must just absolutely be buzzing.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a way to subtly put this in there, but I may as well just say it right off the top. You mentioned his goal-scoring record at the moment. He's got four goals in three league matches. He's got 5 goals in 5 games total. Kenyu Sugimoto, since joining in 2019, has 6 league goals. Kasper Juncker could have 6 league goals in May alone.
Yep.
There's a very real possibility of that happening, and I want everyone to remember that whenever they try to praise Kenyu Sugimoto. It's just seeing him on the pitch, it's night and day from before he joined. Just seeing someone that has that movement of an actual striker who plays on the shoulder of a defender, is ready to make runs, is at least somewhat physical, at least somewhat fast, able to run at defenders, able to pass, able to shoot on target. I can't believe that we actually have that player again. Shinzo Kuroki is getting maybe back to that, but in the meantime, we can enjoy Kasper's run of form and just bask in that glory, because he's the one striker that we have, actual striker playing as a number 9, that is on in form, and he's doing it so well. It looks like he could score from most positions in the box at the moment. He's able to make space. He's reading the play of his teammates really, really well, in that he's able to pull defenders away from them to be able to give them space and time to make passes, and then he's able to run off the shoulder of a defender and get onto that pass to take a chance. And that's something that's been severely lacking for the season before he came in, and to see it happening now is just absolutely magnificent. I can't think of any other words for it.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. A massive impact for Juncker, and he's done absolutely terrifically well in his early days of his Reds career. So, Sam, as we wrap up this game, and also talking about these two teams who incidentally continued their moves in opposite directions here, Reds moved up 2 spots to 6th and above Kobe, who were dropped 1 spot to 8th, which is where Reds began the match day. So, Sam, we're obviously full of praise for Reds here, and it was a very professional performance and a good one, and indeed they do have some very exciting players who have either joined the club this year or have begun to make an impact. Not trying to pour any sort of cold water on things, but this is their first win of the season so far against a team that were currently in the top half of the table. They had beaten Kashima early doors back in match day 7, and Kashima are now a top half team, but at that stage of proceedings, they weren't. So, I don't know, I'm sure, Ryan is obviously wrapping up his players, and he's enjoying things at the moment, but I'm sure he's not getting too carried away himself. But, these recent run of results, with the exception of the Fukuoka loss when Nishikawa had kind of an out-of-body experience, they're chugging along nicely, and they're picking up the results, which is ultimately, I suppose, all you can ask for, isn't it? It's just to beat the team in front of you. They haven't always been ultra-convincing, but, this was a good performance and a further indication of the progression under Rodriguez.
Yeah, it's a professional performance, as you say. I thought Kobe were pretty lackluster in this game. Gamba were awful the week before, and then Sendai weren't great either. But, I mean, they beat them completely professionally without conceding a goal, scoring goals in themselves. I think they've just done it. They've done what they've had to do. I mean, Oita, I thought the game before in April, I thought that was a bit more dodgy, where Oita were quite threatening for most of that game, and it took a little bit of a turnaround from Reds. But generally speaking, this month they could have done much more. He's been tinkering a lot with his team, but seems to have settled on a general foundation for it. Akimoto's now at left back, and I'm glad of that because Yamanaka can't defend, and Akimoto, I mean, even as a winger or a striker or whatever he is, defensively, he's a lot more switched on. The way he tracks his runners is terrific, and it's something Yamanaka could do with looking at. But generally speaking, they've got that. As long as they get Koizumi into that attacking midfield role, I think this team really works. The problem that he's had is that Muto played really well up front. So when Junker comes in, he wanted to move Muto back and keep him in the team. But he just knocked Koizumi either to the left or up to centre mid, and it kind of lost the balance there. But as you saw at the weekend, as soon as he gets into that number 10 position, they're a completely different team. So as long as he keeps that consistency, I'm pretty confident in Reds doing fairly well this year. I mean, we spoke, me and Ryan, on Twitter, like at the beginning of the season, Ryan was quite happy with 8th as a position for them, and I think that's still probably fair for them this year. But they've got the foundations that you could see them pushing into maybe a 6th place if all goes well. If you're looking at the table, you've got a Vispa above them as well as they're playing, and Tosu as well. You can still see them dropping off. So I'm I think they're having a decent year, and I think this month has been very good for them.
Yeah, no question. All right, so happy days at Saitama Stadium. And as I say, you can only beat the teams in front of you. And for the most part, certainly in this month and the last month and a bit, Reds have been doing that almost every time. And so we'll wait and see how things progress further as the midway point of the season looms in front of us. All right, so Ryan has agreed to stick with us for the next two games in part one of this episode. There were two more games on the slate that featured battles of top half teams, just as Reds facing Kobe was. So we'll move on to the real estate agent in front of the Station Stadium, where third-placed Tosu and their league-best defence that had allowed just 6 goals in 15 games hosted Kashima, who had climbed 10 spots in the table to 6th. Coincidentally, since that loss to Reds back in early April, and they'd gone 8 unbeaten since then, scoring 13 in their 4 straight wins since Naoki Soma replaced Zago, with their last 2 wins, of course, being against other top 4 sides, Nagoya and Yokohama F. Marinos, 5-3 last weekend. So Kashima rocked up to Tosu, Sam, and they took a 14th-minute lead through Yuta Matsumura's deflected shot. At that point, I don't know, were you wondering by how many goals Kashima would be winning again this week? If you were, jolted back to earth in the second half when Tosu turned things around.
I don't want to make it sound like I was predicting something when I wasn't, but I thought Tosu started really well, and they were the better team for the first 10-15 minutes before the goal. Just high intensity, Sento had a good effort, and Kashima, they got their goal, and it was quite fortunate. I don't think the Matsumura shot is going in if it wasn't for the deflection. So at that time, I thought Tosu were a little hard done to, but Kashima then probably controlled much of the rest of the first half, and it wasn't until the second half that Tosu really got into gear and just pressed them, harried them, just so much intensity to the way they were playing, and they were fully deserving, I thought, in the second half. But yeah, once Kashima got in front and the way they've been playing, you would say you'd expect Kashima to go on, and they did have a couple of chances. If Shirasaki had scored just before half time, then completely different game if they go in 2-0. But I thought Tosu for large parts of this game were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's been amazing, hasn't it, Ryan, seeing them progress throughout this season. Obviously, very, very much unfancied coming into the season, Tosu, although they had, as we've said many times, made themselves hard to beat in the last month or 6 weeks of the 2020 season. But yeah, when you sit down and watch this game and see what they're capable of with such limited resources, it's amazing, isn't it? They can take this Kashima team to task and yeah, ultimately be full value for the 3 points by scoring their 2 second half goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a large part of that is just in the way they play. They still defend a lot like the Sagan Tosu of old. They have five at the back more often than not. They're very compact. And they make themselves really annoying to get past. But then as soon as they win the ball back, they expand, they open up. They've got their fullbacks right on the line. Their fullbacks are pushing up when the ball comes towards them. They've got, a really expansive attack that actually runs into the box. They've got multiple players that run into the box. Wasn't really like that before. It was kind of before it was just counterattack and hope that Yohei Toyota gets his head on the ball. That was kind of what Sagan Tosu used to play. And now they've got a little bit old, a little bit new, and it just really works for them. That kind of hybrid between the two is just working so well. It's actually really enjoying to watch. I watched the whole match, and it was I prefer watching them over Kashima for sure. They were a much better team.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. So Keita Yamashita, who got their goal early in last week's draw away at Oita, he got them back on level terms 5 minutes into the second half, firing in from 6 yards after Yuya Oki couldn't hang on to Yoshihiro Nakano's low cross in from the left. And then Yuta Higuchi won it for Tosu 11 minutes from time. He rifled home from inside the box after a superb cutback from the previously mentioned Keiya Sento and his razor-sharp haircut. So Tosu continue to do the business. And even obviously they were frustrated last week to draw away at Oita, and then to bounce back against arguably the hottest team in the league is yet another feather in their cap. And spoiler alert for part two, and Nagoya dropped points this weekend, which means that with Tosu having two games in hand on Grampus, they could actually go to second once they've ultimately played those games in hand if they continue on their winning way. So how high can they go? Well, I don't think we agree that they can't catch Kawasaki at this point of things, but you certainly wouldn't put it past them to at least touch second. Whether they'll end up finishing there is up for debate. Just interestingly, Sam, do you think it has sort of an impact on the way that Tosu play, whether they're home or away? I know that they had some ordinary results at home, but this was a particularly good one. Either side of the international break, they're now going to play 4 straight games away from the real estate agent in front of the Station Stadium. So do you think that's to their benefit at all, or the style of football they play, it really doesn't matter where they stump up?
I still don't think it matters, because I think any team that goes to Tosu, they still have that feeling that Tosu are a fairly poor side, and they think they'll have the ball, and it's kind of suits the way Tosu play. The games that Tosu really have struggled in, like last week against Oita, Oita are a team that want to sit back as well, and Tosu didn't really get to grips with it, and Hiroshima was similar. So as long as they're facing a team that's going to attack them, then I think they're perfectly set up for. I mean, midweek they've got Sapporo. They'll love that. That'll be absolutely perfect for them. But yeah, I don't think necessarily home or away is the factor at all. I think they're going to set up the way they set up, no matter where they are, no matter who they're against. And it just kind of, I think, more depends on the opponents as to how successful that approach has been. But I think, especially against the big teams Kashima in this game, I thought they were absolutely superb. And they've shown it usually against Tokyo. They were pretty good as well. Nagoya, they've got the victory. I think home or away, I don't think that matters. Just, more so the opponents.
Yeah, fair enough. They're, yeah, absolutely terrific. And they certainly do have the wood over FC Tokyo, and no question about that. So as you watch this game, Ryan, you know, with the anticipation you were coming onto the podcast, I know you don't watch them their full games on a week-to-week basis. So was there a player or two that stood out to you that, once you got an extended look at them, you were either surprised or you weren't aware how much of an impact they had on the way the team played? Any players that you wanted to single out after watching this game in particular?
Not one in particular. I mean, I think the one I was most disappointed in that match was Eduardo out of Sagantoso. I think he... I don't know if it was just that he's not quite adjusted to the team, but he just seemed to be a bit of a Iwanami of the team. He was a little bit of a liability in defence. He gave away a couple of corners when he didn't really need to, and all that sort of stuff. I think just for me, it was just the team as a whole. The way they work together is what impressed me more than any individual. I didn't really notice, personally, I didn't notice a standout. I just kind of saw the way they played as a whole and then noticed Eduardo wasn't quite living up to what he necessarily should.
It's a dagger to my heart, any criticism of Eduardo.
I'm sorry. He might grow on me. You don't know.
I agree with you. I don't think this was his best game. I think it was a little bit sloppier. But generally speaking, he's been terrific. I won't hear any more bad words said about him.
Well, the listeners will be disappointed there weren't more fisticuffs here. I mean, we made it through the Reds part there, very civilised. Ryan not picking Sam up on his in any of his pre-season predictions about Reds. And then, Ryan wades in on one of Sam's favourites, but it seems like you're happy to bury the hatchet and move on. So, all right.
He didn't jinx our team this year. That's why we're doing so well. But I still had to stick the knife in somehow.
That's what you want from them. Predict them as low as possible, and then you'll be fine.
Very sly, very sly. All right, well, to the third game of part one then, and indeed the other matchup between the top half teams in match day 15. At kickoff, Cerezo Osaka were ninth in the table, and they hosted 10th placed San Frecce. Well, the teams switched spots in the table after Hiroshima enjoyed another very fruitful trip to Osaka just a few weeks after obviously winning at Gumba Osaka. They've stumped up at Cerezo and repeated the dose, this time winning 2-1, and they had to come from behind to do it, just as Itosu did in their game. Hiroaki Okuno gave Cerezo the lead 2 minutes into the second half, but Sanfrecce hit back immediately through Junior Santos, his goal 5 minutes after half-time equalised. And then Yuya Asano, with some controversy, Sam, ultimately won it for Sanfrecce just before the hour with a goal on the counter-attack after Cerezo felt they should have had a penalty for a handball in the box. VAR did have an extended look at it, but ultimately decided that, the referee's decision to waive play on was not a clear and obvious error. How did you feel about that decision in particular, and overall this game, Sanfrecce, coming from behind to win at Cerezo?
Well, the decision's an interesting one. I think 2 years ago it would never be given handball because it's just so close to him and he's not looking at it. He's got his back completely to it. But I think, I mean, it's technically his arms outside of this stupid silhouette and it does hit him lower than the sleeve. So I think by the law, I think it's a penalty. So I'm not 100% sure why it's not been given, but I'm glad it's not, because that's just a thing, that's the sort of handball I'd hate to be given against me. But given the current climate of everything, I can understand why Cerezo would be absolutely furious with that. But and they were just hit completely on the counter-attack, and Santos, and he's got a lot of stick this season. He's not scored many goals, but I think he's been a little bit hard done to. I think the way he can carry the ball long distances, like 40 yards, he can get his team out of trouble. He then, I mean, a lot. He hit the post in the first half. He did get his goal, which would be a great relief to him. But then it was also instrumental in that goal, slipping in Asano. So I thought Hiroshima generally were the better team. Cerezo, really disappointing. I think it was a shame for them. It's I don't know if it's the last game ever at Yanmar, but it's the last game for a while at least. And it was played behind closed doors, which is a real shame. And they're moving back to the Kincho Stadium or whatever they might be calling it now. So it was disappointing, but they didn't really get going, Cerezo. They scored, their goal was against the run of play, and offered very little. I mean, without a striker properly up front, with Taggart's not there, and Okubo's been injured, so without him, they've not really got that option to put their crosses into, which is the kind of the way they want to play. And, yeah, Kiyotake and Sakamoto, maybe not quite as good in this game, at least, as they usually are. So I thought it was a disappointing performance from Cerezo, and I thought Hiroshima, even though there may be an element of luck in their second goal, I think they were the deserved winners.
Yeah, the first two goals were quite scrappy, weren't they, Ryan? Both coming off corners, and then, the controversy around what proved to be the winner. But, I guess from a Hiroshima perspective anyway, this was very much a much-needed victory. And as I said, their second trip to Osaka in the last three games, and they've won both of them, which has helped them immensely. But still, they've been scrapping around in mid-table pretty much all season, haven't they? So they need to go on a bit of a run here if they're going to make themselves relevant in the second half of the season. Otherwise, more mid-table mediocrity looms, I think. I don't want to pour water on them after they've just won this game, but it's one of those where you've got to make it count by going on a run of consecutive victories, don't you? And that's something that's eluded them so far this year.
Yeah, well, they haven't really been super impressive performance wise for a long time, at least in terms of consistent performances. You look at the I'm just trying to think. Couple of years ago, 3 years ago, they got a Champions League qualification. That was the last time they really pushed. They haven't won a title in a long time. They used to be seen as that kind of echelon team, and they've long since been taken, had that position taken from them. And I just kind of wonder how much needs to be changed, because they've still got a lot of players from previous years that clearly need at least a kick up the backside, if not a lot more. Not only the inconsistency, but performances, the way they conceded the goal to Cerezo, and the way they had to concede those other two goals to earn the 3 points, just wasn't really one that you would consider a satisfying result. Regardless, you wouldn't think the performance was satisfying. I just kind of wonder what needs to really be done for them to be able to step up. If not this season, then definitely next season, because I think if it's not this season, then it's a major overhaul that's needed. I don't know. Throw it to one of you two if you got any ideas.
I mean, they're a difficult one to look. They've got a few really good players. Osaka will be a good goalkeeper. I like Kawabe in midfield and Morishima as well. But around them is just a lot of mediocrity. When Nogami is getting playing every game, and he was a bit part player for Yokohama back in J2. I mean, there are just a few things that have gone, they're really weird pickups. They've gone back to this back four this season, which is completely against the way that Hiroshima have played for so long, and they've just not got to grips with it. They are still playing Aoyama in midfield. He's still a linchpin of the team at 35. And it's sort of similar, I think, to the way that Reds were for a while between the Petrovic era and the current Rodriguez era, where you're still playing the same players, and it's just that you're getting worse and worse and worse. So eventually Hiroshima will probably drop into where they'll have that one season where they flirt with relegation. It'll kind of kick them into action to go and do something about it, because they are just stagnating and dropping each season. It doesn't really change anything either. It's just pretty much the same team. He might change a winger here and there, but there's nothing that he looks to be doing that's arresting the slide, and he seems fairly satisfied with one win, one loss, one win, one loss.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, well, we certainly appreciate you checking out Hiroshima's game against Cerezo over the weekend, Brian. But, of course, you were doing so to prep yourself for this Wednesday when Hiroshima host Urawa. So you're going to be seeing an awful lot more of them in this midweek. And then after that, of course, Reds host currently second place at Nagoya before the league goes on a break for the internationals, a break of about 3 weeks. So, yeah, Ryan, we very much appreciate you coming back on and taking some of the questions from our patrons. Very much appreciated. And, yeah, well, it's going to be interesting that these next couple of games, at least to get you through to the international break, with the Reds currently in sixth, and then obviously with a chance to reset after, probably giving some of the squad players an opportunity in the Levain Cup a doubleheader against Kobe. So, mate, yeah, very, as I say, great to catch up with you and appreciate your time on this week's episode.
No, it's been a pleasure. It's been really good to finally talk about somewhat coherent football again. I'm happy to be on.
Outstanding. All right. Well, our thanks to Ryan Steele. After a quick hit of music, Sam and I will round up the other seven games from J1 Matchday 15. Welcome back. And just before we move on to our next batch of games, I neglected to mention at the end of part one, we had a question from Gabrielle Anello on Cerezo Osaka, Sam, and their decision to drop Ayumu Seko and his fellow central defender Nishio for Dankler and Thiago, who have come into the team in recent times. Gab says they seem to struggle, and Cerezo shouldn't throw away Seko and Nishio's development. So you had mentioned that earlier on in the season, I think the week that the initial decision was made, and it looks like it's becoming semi-permanent at this stage of things.
Yeah, they do seem to have stuck with it for now. I mean, I thought Seko and Nishio, they were kind of thrust into it at the start of the season with Jonic gone and no real replacement at the time. But I thought they performed really well. But yeah, since Thiago Pagnussat has come in and Dankler's got himself ready, they've been the centre-back partnership. I mean, I can understand Thiago coming in. He's the big centre-back signing. They think a lot of him. So I can understand why he comes in. I'll never understand Dankler getting into a J-League team, but so be it. I don't think he's played terribly this season, but even so, yeah. I think you're losing something. But there's reports around Seko that he caught COVID with the under-24s. He broke protocols and that sort of thing. So maybe there's some sort of backlash from that. But he came on for the second half in this game. Thiago, I think he is back at the end of the first half. So maybe he gets a run of it again in the next few weeks. But I think it has been harsh on both Seko and Nishio, especially the way Nishio came in and took to the league very nicely.
Yeah, fair enough. And all right, well, so, thanks to Gab for his question. Apologies, we didn't put it in the right place in the podcast when we were talking about Cerezo, but hopefully we made it up to you there, Gab, and we'll move on to some of the games involving other teams in the top six over the weekend who faced struggling bottom half opponents. So hardly marquee games on paper, but there were a couple of surprising results from them. We'll begin at Todoroki and a top versus bottom battle where the unbeaten runaway leaders and defending champions Kawasaki hosted Yokohama FC, who came in off their first and a potentially only win of the season at home to Shonan last week. I said on last week's episode, Sam, that this could have been a rugby score, but instead it ended 3-1 to the defending champions. They went 2-0 up inside the first half hour through an Ienaga penalty and an Aotanaka strike in off the post, and then Okaro Mitoma made it 3-0 2 minutes after the break. I guess at which point we probably wondered, yes indeed, whether it would end up being a rugby score, but Yokohama FC, they got a consolation goal through Kleber just after the hour, and I guess another one of these games where Kawasaki take their foot off the gas in the second half.
Yeah, they just stopped playing after at 3-0. I thought the rest of that second half was as bad as I've seen Kawasaki play in a long while, and I think Onike needs to kind of get them in and make them rewatch that, because it wasn't good enough. Yokohama just dominated most of the second half and at least deserved the one goal back, probably a couple more than that. But yeah, I mean, Kawasaki, when you're 3-0 up, I suppose, and they just keep winning, you're going to get into those kind of complacent mindsets, and I think that's what this game was, because if they were on it for the entire game, then yeah, the rugby score could have been on. But yeah, it was just a foot off the pedal, just no energy really, and yeah, really kind of poor to watch. But maybe you have to give Yokohama a bit of credit, they kept going at 3-0, they kept attacking, they did deserve their goal, and they created a few more chances. But I think mainly it was just down to Kawasaki saying the job was done at 3-0 and coasting.
All right. Well, yeah, we mentioned they made a fast start, at least in terms of getting a two on the board before the half hour. And Leandro Damião, Sam, you'd mentioned the last time that Neil Debman was on, his work rate and his pressing, his willingness to run himself into the ground to close down opponents, and that was fully on display for Tanaka's goal, the second on the afternoon, and then he almost scored a miraculous goal himself just before half time when he closed down Eijiro Takeda, didn't he? So it was another one of those games where Leandro Damião further enhances his reputation amongst the Frontale faithful.
Yeah, it's been the biggest change in his game, I think, in the last year and a half. Well, no, maybe just a year. I mean, I don't know what Ichikawa's doing. He knows that Damián and the rest of the Frontale team are going to press him, and he just takes forever and dallies on it. So, yeah, he only really has himself to blame. But, yeah, full credit to Damián causing that one goal, almost getting a second. I mean, it's just when Kawasaki are on it and he's doing that, the whole team responds. And yeah, that's probably why one of the reasons that sets Kawasaki apart from the rest of the league. It's not just that they're very good footballers, it's because they work incredibly hard, usually, except for the second half.
Indeed. And for their third, yeah, just after the break, three players who have been called up to either the under-24s or the full national team for upcoming internationals. Al Tanaka played a ball through for Miki Yamane, who crossed for Mitoma to knock in from inside the 6-yard box. And then, Kleber with his goal just past the hour, heading in Eijiro Takeda's dinked cross. The ball had apparently crossed the line. I wasn't sure whether the linesman had actually signalled or not, Sam. Yota Maijima did fire in just to make sure, but ultimately the goal has been credited to Kleber. And I don't know, did you notice the linesman heading off to the centre circle? Because I wasn't sure it was given in the first place.
No, I think they gave it for Maijima, and then for whatever reason had a VAR review to decide who'd scored. I mean, it doesn't matter, it's a goal. decide on your own time. But yeah, I think it is a clever goal. But yeah, whatever it was, Yokohama scored, they should have just got on with it and played on.
Yeah, fair enough. So I guess, yeah, Kawasaki, we can excuse them taking their foot off the gas here. But Yokohama FC, on the back of that first win last season, they ultimately were not disgraced here. And their second half performance, they were a pretty decent value and, deserved at least the goal they got. And as Sam says, perhaps even a little bit more. So next to the Pocari Sweat Stadium, where Tokushima hosted Nagoya, Virtus finally got back to winning ways for new coach Danny Poyatos last week in Hiroshima, but knew that Grampus and their record-setting defence would be a tough nut to crack, even without captain Yuichi Maruyama, who missed his first league game since August 2019. Maruyama had started 62 straight games in the league for Nagoya, but after going off injured just before the hour last weekend, he missed out here with Yasuki Kimoto partnering Shinosuke Nakatani in central defence. We know that Kimoto had come in on a couple of occasions already this season to give Nakatani a breather, Sam. So how did this partnership look with Maruyama? His absence, I imagine, it would have been sorely felt. But I mean, these the two experienced centre backs, and how did they cope in Maruyama's absence?
I thought, generally speaking, they were comfortable. There were a couple of occasions where Takashima would go a bit more direct up to Kakita, and he'd win the header against one of them and knock it down for Miyashiro. So that's where Takashima had the odd occasion of danger in this game. But generally speaking, I thought both defended pretty well. Nakatani took the captain's armband. He led it across, led the team pretty well. He was very vocal back there, and I thought Nagoya in general were pretty solid, as they usually are. But Takashima I was a little disappointed in, because when you see Maruyama not there, I think you should go for it a little bit more than they did. But they brought Konishi in to play on the right wing, which is really just an extra central midfielder. And yeah, they just didn't go for it. They didn't, I don't know if they believed themselves that they'd be able to break them down, but they came and looked like they were settling for the point. And I mean, on the face of it, a point against Nagoya is a very good one for them.
Indeed. So, yes, it did ultimately end up a 0-0 draw at the Bakari Sweat Stadium. So, yeah, Vortis unable to build on last week's victory. And I guess, well, from an attacking perspective here for Grampus, Sam, they'll be disappointed not to win this game against a team who, yeah, began the match day 12th in the table. And ultimately, at the end of the day, they've dropped two more points. If it wasn't impossible already for them to catch Kawasaki, the gap is now 12 points. And as we mentioned earlier, if Futosu happen to win their two games in hand whenever they're played and carry on their good form, then they could even go above Grampus and into second. So, yeah, it's one of those where Grampus just can't afford to have an off day going forward, can they? If they were going to, you know, have any intention of hanging on to Kawasaki's coattails, but I mean, that's well and truly gone now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And it's just another one of those occasions where the lack of real centre forward has cost them. I mean, they had a couple of chances. Kakitani probably had the best one, but dragged it wide, didn't really test the keeper. And Yamasaki had another one into the side netting. But really, they need a lot of chances, those strikers, to get a goal. And when Mateus has not created something out of nothing, they really struggle to break down a team. And Mateus wasn't quite on it in the same way he was against Shimizu the week before. And yeah, without him performing miracles, Nagoya just, yeah, really toothless kind of in front of goal.
Yeah, so a somewhat surprising result down at the Bukhari Sweat Stadium, and another one at the Nissan Stadium, where Yokohama F. Marinos hosted Kashiwa Reysol. F. Marinos looking to bounce back and take out their frustrations from last week's 5-3 battering at Kashima on seemingly hapless Reysol, who travelled over to Kanagawa on the back of three straight defeats. Of course, the last weekend getting hammered themselves 4-0 at home by FC Tokyo. So wouldn't you know it, Sam, this is, of course, the magic of the J-League. Reysol outshot F. Marinos 13-8, and the game ended 1-1.
Yeah, I thought they were the better team as well. I mean, they were fantastic, I thought. They changed their system up. They got rid of the back three. They went pretty much a 4-4-2. They did what I've been trying to get them to do for so long and get Nakama, Kamiya and Isaka as kind of the attacking players. They got rid of Ancelotti up front, and they were a lot brighter. I mean, as with every game, Yokohama had all the possession and they kept it for long periods. But Kashiwa, sort of similar to the Gamba game, where they were just on the counter-attack, and in that game it was Isaka, I thought, that kind of ran the game. In this one it was Nakama with his passing, and they will feel very aggrieved to have not won this game. Kamiya especially had a few chances which he wasted, and they got in front, and then immediately afterwards they are stung by an absolute worldie of a goal from the right back, Matsubara, which, I mean, it's probably worthy of getting a point in any game, but I thought Kashiwa were night and day from the way they've been playing for most of this season.
Yeah, absolutely amazing, isn't it? And amazing, Jay, just for a change. So F. Marinos did hit the post through Ador Naiwu's header on the hour. Jun Amano crossed in from the left, and Onaiwu's header hit Kim Sengyu's right-hand post and bounced across the along the goal line, rather, not across it. And thankfully for Reysol, to safety. Then Yuta Kamiya seemingly had to score for Reysol about 10 minutes later, but his shot from alongside the penalty spot was straight at Yohei Takaoka when he had almost all of the goal to aim at, and then he bundled his follow-up wide just for good measure. But then Ippei Shinozuka, formerly, of course, of Yokohama F. Marinos, was never a regular there, but was a part of the squad and called on from time to time, I believe under Eric Mombatz, if I'm not mistaken, before Shinozuka moved on to Omiya and now Kashiwa. Anyway, he slid in at the back post to steer home Hayato Nakama's cross from deep on the left. Nelsinho obviously very excited about that goal on the touchline. And in this week, in Ange Postecoglou lip reading, I'm pretty sure Ange mouthed bastard when Shinozuka's goal was scored. But the worldie that Sam's mentioned from Ken Matsubara 4 minutes later and 4 minutes from time ultimately earned F. Marinos a point. Seemingly out of absolutely nothing, Matsubara received from Teruhito Nakagawa and blasted in from 30 yards. Makes you wonder why he doesn't do that every week, Sam. He made it look very easy, didn't he?
Well, he tries, but often it goes high and wide or blocked. I mean, this he'll never score a goal like it again. I don't think it's absolutely postage stamp into the top corner. It's just terrific goal. I mean, yeah, full credit to him. It's a wonderful strike, and I'd argue it's probably taken the lead in the goal of the season poll.
Yeah, just about, I reckon. Ultimately then, question we had from Tokyo Fox on Raceol before we wrap up F. Marinos' afternoon. Sam, a Tokyo Fox would like to know if Raceol were the better side in this game, or was that just the biased highlights that he saw on the official Raceol YouTube channel? Tokyo Fox goes on to say such channel highlights often try to gloss over the opponent's chances and goals as if they didn't happen. But from what he saw, Raceol looked unfortunate not to go away with all 3 points. And from what you've said so far, it sounds like you're in agreement.
Yeah, I thought they were the better team. They created the better chances. Yes, Yokohama did it at the post, but it's a really good header from Onaira rather than it being a glorious opportunity for him. And the goal they scored is like 30, 35 yards out. So, yeah, I thought they were pretty solid. Kashiwa and Kim really wasn't tested too much, and the best chances fell to them. They soaked up pressure, but hit them on the counter-attack and looked, yeah, quite clearly, I thought, the more threatening team. And, yeah, a point, although it's better than nothing for them the way they've been going this season. Yeah, I think they really did deserve the 3.
All right, and so finally then for F. Marinos, this has obviously been a really frustrating couple of games after they had shaped as the most likely challenger to Frontale. And, I mean, they still might end up finishing second, but, you know, dropping, 5 points in their last two games is certainly, I think, sounded a death knell for any of the faintest of possibilities they had of trying to mow down Frontale. But I guess this is just further example of F. Marinos not really being the finished article, as I think you've mentioned throughout the season at different points, Sam.
Yeah, they've played very well for large parts of this season, but they do have these sorts of blips in them, I think. And they've got 4 games in hand on Kawasaki, but if they win all those, which is a tall feat in itself, but they're still 8 points behind. I mean, I just don't think they've got it about them. There are a few areas I still think there are issues there. Takaoka, he kept his place in this game after his horror show last week. I think they can do better there. I still think the fullbacks can be better defensively. I know that there's this saying that Yokohama don't care about defence, but to win a title, I think you have to care about it a little bit more. So there are still areas there. And maybe you'd say this, Anaiwu and Maeda have played very well. Maybe you need, and Elbert has as well, but I don't know if there's necessarily the most clinical of striker there that might be. So, I mean, if you chucked a Kasper Juncker into this team, for example, then they'd be right up at the top of the league. I think as well as they've played, I think they're all playing like at their absolute best. And I don't think there's one necessarily natural goal scorer in there that you can just rely on week in, week out. So, yeah, I think there are a few areas there. But, I mean, Marinos are a good team. I won't take anything away from them. But just maybe one or two players away from being that consistent threat to Kawasaki.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so 2 points dropped for F. Marinos on Saturday, or you could say a point earned, as Sam said several times, Racehall were, in his opinion, the better of the teams at the Nissan Stadium, and so that point moved F. Marinos on to 28, and joining them on the same points tally, staying in fifth behind F. Marinos on goal difference, Avispa Fukuoka, well, if it weren't for Tosu in third, Avispa are absolutely the most unbelievable story of this season so far. Of course, we've mentioned it in recent weeks, they'd roared up the table from 11th to 5th on the back of five straight wins. So, I mean, they were hardly struggling at the start of this winning run. But, they've soared up the table, and 5th is where they stayed. But they won for the 6th straight game, Sam, against Shawnun. Obviously, Belmari had their 8-match unbeaten run smashed to smithereens by Yokohama FC at last time out, although they were dudded by VAR, and they're not for the first time this season. There was another VAR intervention here against Takuya Okamoto yet again. I think they're voodoo dolls up in the VAR HQ with Okamoto's kit on. That must be the only explanation. But yeah, another example, Sam, of a team coming from behind to win. Fukuoka had to fight back after Shintaro Nago gave Shonan a 32nd-minute lead. And it was a couple of their big Brazilians who did the trick with two quick-fire goals midway through the second half.
It was another good fight back from Avispa, because Shonan were generally, I thought, the better team for a lot of this game, at least at the start, and they deserved their goal, which was a really tight onside call, which looked completely offside when I first saw it, but slowing it down, he is just about onside, so fair play to the linesman for getting that decision right. But yeah, Avispa, they don't know when they're beaten, and especially when no team can seem to defend a Salamanca on free kick over a corner, because that's where they got the two goals. It's another quality delivery, for the first one, especially onto Mendes's head. And the second one, it also meets Mendes's head, which is saved and Grolly puts it in. But I've got a question they've shown I'm defending, where Takahashi is the one they've put onto Mendes both times, and he's got nowhere near him on both occasions. And you just got to think, you've got to have your centre back on there, the opposition striker, or at least someone who can physically match Mendes, because he was completely on top in those situations. And yeah, Shonan just couldn't deal with it. But you should know what's going to happen with Avispa, but that's how they score their goals, is set pieces. But yeah, no one seems to have got to grips with them, and Avispa are reaping the rewards from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And goals from set pieces, as you said. And they'll take them any way they can get them. They're in absolute dreamland up in fifth. And well and truly, good value for their position in the table. One of our patrons, Daniel, is absolutely in dreamland himself, and he just wants to know, Sam, after six straight league wins, how long can Avispa keep this up? Have you looked ahead to their upcoming fixtures? Obviously, again, we don't want to pour water on anything, cold water on anything here, but I mean, do you think things are going to start to get a little bit more tricky for them in the weeks to come?
Well, not immediately, as they play Yokohama FC in midweek, and then they've got Oita the following weekend. So going into the international break, I think they'll be expecting 6 more points and be in a very nice position before the Emperor's Cup comes in. And then I think it's almost a month now until they play Vissel Kobe after that, which is, that's a tough game coming up. But yeah, I mean, the way the fixtures have gone for them, they look quite nice. And yeah, the longer they spend in the top three, as it could be, you never know with Avispa, the better they'll feel. I mean, they're so close, I think, now to getting at least the points to be safe. And it's at that point, as we were talking about last week, what do they do when they hit that kind of 40-point mark? Do they go and think, we can get into the ACL for argument's sake, or do they just sit back and think, job done? So it'd be interesting to see. I hope they go for the former and really push on, because I mean, yeah, they've got enough weapons to kind of harm a lot of teams in this league. It's not pretty. It's not flowing Yokohama F. Marinos football or anything like that, but it's very effective. So, yeah, who knows how far this can go, but at least for another week.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. As you say, yeah, the next two fixtures could hardly be any kinder on paper, could they? So, brilliant stuff again from Fukuoka. For Shonan, Well, ultimately, VAR pinged Takuya Okamoto again, Sam, but he got off after he was judged to have handled a cross just before halftime when his goalkeeper, Kosei Tani, guessed right and dived right to save Bruno Mendes' spot kick. It looked like it hit Okamoto in a similar position to the penalty that was given in... that wasn't given in the Cerezo Hiroshima game. So, I mean, do you agree that the comparison there? And obviously, we would like a bit of consistency, wouldn't we? But Okamoto, he just can't take a trick, can he?
Yeah, consistency would be nice. I suppose the only thing with this one is there's a longer distance away from the ball, and he's facing it, so he does stick his arm out to block it. So I think it's a penalty. The referee, he's gone over to his video monitor. He's seen the name on the back of the shirt, so that's an immediate penalty against Okamoto. But I think this was a penalty. I think he can't have too many complaints about this one as much as he might have done with previous things that have gone against him. It's just whether... I think the mistake, if there is a mistake, is probably in the Cerezo one, where letter of the law, that should be a penalty.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, something that I've missed as we've been going along, and this winning streak has continued for Fukuoka, is that their haul of 28 points is now, in fact, three full wins better than their last time they were in J1. They amassed a total of 19 points across two stages back in 2016, and on 28, they've already obliterated that total. They went down, obviously, rock bottom in 2016, one of the worst seasons in J1 history. But, at this stage, they are absolutely flying high, and that is very much a distant memory, and Fukuoka aiming as high as they can go, as Sam said, with a couple of very tasty looking fixtures on their plate before the international break. We'll move on then. Those are the other games that involve teams in the top six, and that leaves us, Sam, with three games that were bottom half battles in match day 15. Teams in the bottom half of the table squaring off. Firstly, then, we'll begin with the late game on Saturday and the collapsing for Kazama Derby at Ajinomoto Stadium. As we mentioned earlier, it was the late kickoff. FC Tokyo hosted Gamba Osaka. Sam, Gamba kicked off, and 46 seconds later, Diego Oliveira was volleying Tokyo into the lead from close range. And after that, well, it would be an exaggeration to say that nothing else happened. I mean, Tokyo could have been 3-0 up inside the first 10 minutes. But, that was definitely the major talking point of the game in the first 45 seconds. And then from there, Tokyo ultimately saw out a 1-0 victory.
Yeah, I mean, that 45 seconds just summed up where Gamba are at the moment. Get the kick off, back to the centre-back. He boots it out of play for a throw-in, and then just get nowhere near it from then on, and Tokyo score. And it could have been very similar to the Kashua game last week, where Tokyo could have been 3-up quite early on, and perhaps should have been. I mean, especially the Tagawa shot off the crossbar. But Gamba just were awful again. I mean, they changed their back line where they got rid of the centre-back partnership of Miura and Shoji and put Miura out to right back to fill that berth that no one can fill. And Suganuma was probably at most fault for the goal. I mean, he got breezed past by Uchida and, got nowhere near him. And then going forward, you expect something from Gamba, but there were a couple of shots from the edge of the area, but really that was it. I mean, with all the attacking talents, you expect a lot more, but again, it was pedestrian. It just didn't look like they were overly bothered about it, and I thought they were really poor, and Tokyo didn't necessarily play as well as they could have done after the first 10-15 minutes, but I thought they were in control of the game, and if anyone else was going to score, it was going to be them.
Yeah, Gamba did have a little flurry before half-time, didn't they, when Leandro Pereira had a shot saved by Go Hatano, and then in stoppage time, Dai Tsukamoto dribbled superbly through the centre of the park, but then, shot too close to Hatano, but that was pretty much as good as it got for Gamba, and I'm certainly not going to pile on after the way Tokyo had been performing in the last month or 6 weeks, so... It ultimately could have been more comfortable from a Tokyo perspective if they had have made their early dominance in the first 10 minutes count, but after that, just happy to win the game, and sympathise with Gumba and their supporters, because as we're going to come on to later, with the Sendai winning, Gumba actually dropped a spot to second from bottom now, 19th in the table. Again, with the caveats, they have games in hand, but at this stage, that's seemingly irrelevant, isn't it, Sam? Because they're playing these games. They're not really catching any up yet, but they're playing games on a week-to-week basis along with everybody else, but they're just not doing anything. And they're, as you say, they're looking listless. They're looking devoid of ideas. And the most un-Gumba stat of all time is, 3 goals in 12 games. And how many of those are goals they've scored from open play? I think it's only the one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely remember the one penalty from Patrick.
And the Ichimi goal was actually, should have been an own goal, shouldn't it, off the Hiroshima keeper. So it's, it was Usami's goal against Tosu is the only goal they've scored themselves from open play,
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. They're going into a period now before this international break where they've got Tokushima, Yokohama FC and Shonan. And, I mean, they have to get points out of that. If they come out of that without winning at least two of them, I'd be very disappointed. They'd be almost catching up in terms of number of games at that point. And if they still find themselves in the relegation zone, before they then go off to the ACL, where they'll fall further behind and could come back rooted to the bottom of the table. I mean, we've all said for a lot of this season, Gamba aren't going to go down. They'll come out of it. But if they find themselves rock bottom by the time they come back after the ACL and like a large points deficit, I mean, they're in serious trouble. I mean, these three games are as important as any in the last however many years for Gamba Osaka.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll wait and see how they get on there. As you say, they just have to get 7 points would be the minimum you would be hoping for. But Gamba supporters certainly would not be taking anything for granted at this stage. Before we leave this game, there was another question for Daniel on FC Tokyo. Have Tokyo finally turned the corner? I'll field that one, Sam. And Daniel, it's two straight wins with clean sheets, which is in some way Tokyo getting back to their DNA. And I guess most pleasingly, they've looked more expressive going forward. And whether they've patched things up behind the scenes or not, they actually look like they give a damn, and they're playing together, and they're actually playing for the shirt. Where during that five game winless run, where they were just getting torn to shreds at will, they just look like they were not interested at all. Where the getting that burst of goals early against the Kashiwa will have done their collective confidence the world of good, and regular listeners have heard me pile on Keigo Higashi over the years. I mean, the fact that he's been dropped for the last two games and Yojiro Takahagi has come in, and he just offers more going forward. He offers a spark going forward, and I think you could see, especially last week, the impact he had on the first half performance when Tokyo led 3-0 at halftime against Reysol. And again, he was influential here. He played his part in the goal. He released Takuya Uchida, who, as Sam said, breezed past Shunya Suganuma before teeing up Diego Oliveira. So, Takahagi's offered something different to Tokyo from an attacking perspective. And, whether that's freed up the rest of the team, Shuto Abe has looked back to somewhat of his best. He looks more like the 2020 Shuto Abe than the player who seemingly had his tail between his legs after coming back after his protocol breach. So, have they turned the corner? Well, I mean, the last couple of games have been good, because obviously we're ready to sack the coach, and whether that's still happening behind the scenes, I don't know. But the last two results have been positive, albeit against the bottom half opponents. And you never take anything for granted as a Tokyo supporter, but they do have a good recent record against Gumba Osaka, and that continued on Saturday night. All right, so two games to go, Sam, and we will actually move on next to Sendai, because while we're talking about Gumba and them slipping down to second from bottom, Vegalta are up to the giddy heights of 17th after a 2-1 win over Oita. And there was an early flurry from both sides here. It was 1-1 by the 15th minute with Shun Nagasawa bagging again, Sam. But finally, it was Chihiro Kato, the young forward, who scored an absolutely terrific winner 15 minutes from time. That won it for Vegalta, who don't look now, but they might be making a habit of winning at home for the first time in about 3 years.
Well, it was certainly overdue, so I'm glad they're getting a few things to cheer about up there at the Tech Stadium. But, yeah, I actually enjoyed this game, which I didn't expect to when I first saw the fixture announced. But, yeah, both teams started pretty brightly. I thought Vegalta, got their goal. A little bit of fortune about the Nishimura one, a bit similar to the Matsumura one for Kashima. And then Oita, I thought, responded very well. I mean, there's finally a little bit more playing to Nagasawa's strengths in that you need the ball whipped into him to head it in, because the way that they've usually played is quite nice football, progressive, playing it in on the ground, and that's not really his style. But yeah, if the first goal they scored is a cross in, match it a volley, Nagasawa was there. And I mean, Vegalta got the win, but I think it was a little bit harsh on Oita. I thought for quite a lot of this game they were the better team. And Vegalta just about hung into it. They showing a little bit more defensive ability than they have previously. I think Foginho getting into that holding midfield role has really given them a bit more steel in there, a bit more protection, which they've needed. And Oita, I mean, they're not very clinical, which is their main issue. But yeah, I think the kind of game changers in this game were more on the Vegalta side. I think Kato has been the most positive player to come out of Sendai this season. He got another goal for them. And yeah, I think they just took their chances, but it wasn't like the greatest standard of football, but it was an exciting game.
Indeed, indeed. So, yeah, a goal for Nagasawa early on, and indeed he might have equalised in the second half stoppage time, Sam, but a spectacular save from a Jakub Slavik leaping to his right to deny the big golden boot Smokey. Sendai rising, as I said, two spots up to 17th, and Oita slipping a spot to 18th after this. An encouraging performance again on the back of the home draw against Tosu last week. But Oita need victories, and they're not coming for them. But we shouldn't take anything away from Sendai. As Sam said, Chihiro Kato has been absolutely terrific this season. His goal 10 minutes after he came off the bench ultimately won it here for the hosts. Akaki Chino 11 is back with another question about some of the relegation threatened teams. Akaki Chino 11 says that he has the impression that Sendai have recovered a little in the past weeks, and not only with the two wins recently, but of course they had their draw away at Kawasaki, and even in some of the games that they lost against Urawa and Fukuoka, they had their chances, Sam. So do you think they might be able to turn it around? Kakichino 11 asks. Certainly of the bottom four at the moment, they are certainly in the best form. Akakichino 11 says to him at the moment, Yokohama FC, Oita and Shimizu look worse. Shimizu, of course, just 2 points outside the drop zone at the moment. Akakichino 11 is also starting to worry about Kashiwa, he says, and tellingly hasn't mentioned Gunma Osaka at all there, Sam, but obviously they are right in the mix of things at the moment. But Sendai, as we've just said, I mean, in recent times, things have looked to turn around for them. And I mean, to be perfectly honest, things couldn't have hardly gone much worse, could they?
No, I mean, I agree with Akikichino 11 there with saying that Yokohama, Oita and Shimizu are playing worse. That's definitely the case. I saw enough about Kashiwa in that game against Yokohama to think that it will eventually get better for them. But yeah, I think Sendai, they're getting there. They've kind of solidified that back line where they've got Yoshino and Hirioka is settled now. Shimamata, as good as he was in his debut season, I mean, he's just forgotten how to play football. So they've got rid of him there, and Appia as well, who had played really poorly. As I said, Foginho's come in, he's really added something to that midfield. And Nishimura, after a kind of wasn't particularly complimentary about him earlier this month. I mean, he got his goal with the handball against Kashua, and he's played a lot better since then. And the most intriguing thing about Sendai is this Felipe Cardoso, who's come in from I can't remember if it was Fluminense or Santos or a combination of both, but he's got a lot of pedigree about him. He started off in Brazil very hot and then just dropped off. But, I mean, if they get him fit, if he gets to anywhere near the level he showed in Brazil at the start of his career, I mean, he's only 22, but he started off really hot. If he can score goals, I mean, then they've got, on paper at least, the best player out of that bottom section of teams, if we're ignoring Gamba just for now. But yeah, if he comes in and scores goals, then they've got every chance. Shimizu, and we'll get onto them in the next game, but they are looking dreadful. So Sendai will see them as an opportunity to get out of the relegation places ahead of them. And yeah, they've been very good in general, I thought, this month. I thought against Avispa they were the better team, and they lost that game 1-0. They showed real fight against Kawasaki, especially, to come back to get that 2-2. And now they're kind of grinding out victories as well. So, yeah, fair play for them for their turnaround, because those first couple of months were so bad.
Yeah, terrific stuff. So, well done to Sendai on this win. And, yeah, as we've said, things are looking up for them. Yeah, certainly that cannot be said for Shimizu S-Pulse after yet another demoralising performance for them away at Sapporo in the early game on Saturday. Sapporo have ultimately won this game 2-0 at the Sapporo Dome. A quick-fire two-goal burst early in the second half for Anderson Lopez and Takuro Kaneko getting the goals for Consadole. But, well, obviously, yeah, Gamba and their supporters will be shouting out that they're the most disappointing team of the season so far. But S-Pulse cannot be far behind us, Sam. This performance was just the latest incarnation of that. They just look absolutely listless, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, first half, which was a non-event in general, but they were pretty much slightly the better side. At least they had a couple of decent chances, so going to say. But second half, as soon as... right at the start of the second half, I think there was an effort from Bothroyd which went just wide. And then from then on, it was all Sapporo. Shimizu offered absolutely nothing. And it was pretty easy for them to carve through. I mean, Fukumori has good delivery, but for the goal, the first goal, it's a straight diagonal. And they just don't deal with it or even look like dealing with it. And from then on, it was just a pretty listless display. The only time they went forward was right, I think, like the 94th minute when they got the red card because Kim decided to, I don't know what he was doing, dallying on possession and then bringing down Ibasuki, which is unnecessary because he wasn't going to score when he went through anyway. But it was just a really, really embarrassing performance from Shimizu. You expect them to defend under Lotina, and they've not been able to defend properly. And whatever incarnation of strikers they're trying to play up front, nothing's working. They tried Di Saro in this game. I'm not sure he touched the ball very often, maybe a handful of touches before he went off. And yeah, it's just, there's nothing about them. And they're good players. You'd think they're good players at Shimizu. We've seen Nishizawa have good seasons. Kaneko have good seasons. He's not playing too much. Carlinhos can be a good player. But yeah, I mean, it's just not working for them. And teams this season have been fairly quick across all divisions, unless you're at Omia, to sack their manager and try and work things out. And I think Lotina might be, well, maybe Shimizu were in the Kazama race with Tokyo and Gamba.
Well, yeah, I broached the subject last week and thought it might have been a bit too early. But yeah, if he's not able to get more out of his players than what they put on display on Saturday, then yeah, his time might be just about up there, Mr. Lotina. But I tell you what, yeah, if anything sums up Shimizu's day and probably their entire month, Sam, it has to be Ibusuki's free kick after the red card, doesn't it? I mean, Kim Minte is sent off and the referee initially gives a penalty. It's a change to a free kick as, Kim had brought down Ibusuki just outside the box. So Ibusuki lines up the free kick, sets up players in front of the wall for something to create some sort of a diversion, and then fires his free kick straight into his teammates crouching in front of the wall. So, I mean, if 5 seconds ever summed up Shimizu's season so far, then surely that's got to be it.
That's absolutely glorious. It was fairly similar to, I think Tokushima had one earlier in the season where they blasted Watai's head and he went off, I think, with suspected concussion. So I don't really know what he's gained from those players kneeling in front of the wall. I sort of understand the defender behind the wall to block one that goes under it, but I don't know what their position was for. And Ibasuki obviously didn't like them there because he just started to clear him away.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. All right, then. So that's all of the 10 games from Match Day 15 rounded up. Match Day 16 will be played in midweek this week with the 9 games on Wednesday and Gunma Osaka hosting Tokushima on Thursday. Sam, I believe you'll have one of your smash hit round review write-ups exclusively for J-Talk patrons after Wednesday night's game. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, probably Wednesday. And I'll probably add a thing for Gamba on Thursday at some stage. But, yeah, it's going to be difficult. All 9 games kicking off at one time, so I'll need all the screens available as possible. And I'll do my best to get something out as quickly as possible.
Absolutely terrific. All right, so then Match Day 17 will be played on the weekend with just the one game on the Saturday night, Kashiwa hosting Sapporo, and the other 9 on Sunday. So obviously for international listeners, Sam, it'll be difficult for them to schedule midweek games, I suppose, with the games on at any hour of the day during the week, which makes it difficult to watch. But so in the Match Day 17 slate, which for many teams is their last game before the international break, what's your pick of the weekend slate?
Well, I'll pick one probably at the nicest time for everyone. It's the 11 a.m. kickoff here in England, probably midday in Europe and wherever. But Kawasaki versus Kashima, two traditionally very heavyweights of the league. Both, Kashima pretty poor against Tosu. I think Frontale will need a kick up the backside of the way they played in the second half. But this should have all action in it. I mean, maybe Everaldo comes back for Kashima, gives them a bit of a boost. Maybe Ueda does the same. So I just think, two really good teams. And it should be a really interesting and probably a one-all draw, because that's how every one of my predicted games goes.
Yes. I wasn't going to mention that earlier on, but yes, you are in a rare vein of form. So if you happen to be a betting man, then you might want to pile on the draw in this particular game. All right, so just before we go, Sam, and obviously we have been podcasting for quite a while this evening, we better just touch on the national team situation, because this actually took me by surprise late last week with all these games coming up in quick succession. So the Japan national team, of course, are coming off 2 games back in March when they beat South Korea 3-0 in a friendly and then beat Mongolia 14-0 in a World Cup qualifier away, in inverted commas, at Chiba. Well, this Friday, May the 28th, Japan will host Myanmar at the same stadium, the Fukudodenchi Arena, in a World Cup qualifier. The Japan squad of 26 is featuring only overseas-based players. As we've just mentioned, there's a J1 Games in midweek and on this coming weekend. So that is a fully overseas-based squad. Then domestic players come into the squad for the other 4 games during this international break. And interestingly enough, Tatsuhiro Sakamoto of Cerezo Osaka was that one name that stood out for me in that squad. So it's a friendly on Thursday, the 3rd of June, against Jamaica. And another friendly in there as well against Serbia, sandwiched in between World Cup qualifiers against Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan that will both be played at the Suita City Stadium. So, Sam, just your thoughts on the national team squad, both, I guess, the overseas-based one and then the one that also features domestic-based players. Were there any major surprises for you in there?
I wouldn't say major surprises. I mean, Kawashima should always be a major surprise when he gets another call up. But I suppose for the overseas squad, I don't think there are many more than 3 international quality overseas goalkeepers for him. So I guess he had to be picked. There's it's same old team, I think, where there's nothing too exciting. I like Sakamoto. being picked in the kind of second squad as it is. The biggest omission I'd say would be Yuma Suzuki as Japanese strikers in Europe. I think he's been the most prolific this season. He's been very good for St. Trudens, but he's not been picked. I know there's been a bit of talk that maybe it's because he criticised Moriyasu a while ago. I'm not exactly sure what he said there, but yeah, the Osaka and Asano, there's only two strikers. Asano hasn't actually got a club at the moment after he left Partizan Belgrade because they weren't paying him. So it's, yeah, but there's not really, I don't think there's too much of interest in this squad, to be honest. Taniguchi coming back is maybe of interest, but it's so difficult when you've got the two squads, the overseas, the regional one, or the domestic one. Then you've got the under-24s, which takes away a lot of what would be in this squad. So it's a bit of a hodgepodge. But looking at the fixtures, the qualifiers, they should all be fairly straightforward. So it might be the game against Serbia, which is the most interesting to see how this Japan team can fare against a fairly good European side.
Yeah, fair enough then. So, Sam, yeah, you mentioned the under-24s. They also have two games scheduled over the international break. On the 5th of June, they'll play Ghana's under-24s at the Fukuoka Stadium. And then, goodness knows what the Jamaican national team are going to be doing with themselves in between their game against the full national team on the 3rd of June and then their game against the under-24s on June the 12th. They're going to have quite the time, I would imagine, in Japan. They'll be living it up in the city. So it's going to be interesting. Yeah, the under-24s of Japan will play the full Jamaican national team on Saturday the 12th. And most interestingly from this squad, Sam, is obviously the fact that Maya Yoshida, Hiroki Sakai and Wataru Endo have been named in that squad as overage players. So if there was ever an a very clear indication of what Hajime Moriyasu is thinking of about his Olympic squad and the overage players he's going to call up, I think we've just found out, haven't we?
Yeah, I think so. It'd be very weird if he decided to change it now. But yeah, I think we got two out of the three, and we definitely mentioned Yoshida as well. So yeah, well done to us. But that's still maybe like Osaka in there. But I mean, the four strikers, Hayashi, Maeda, Ueda, Tagawa, they're all scoring goals, so I don't think we can argue too much about it. Zion Suzuki actually gets in after his performances, so that's full credit to him. And maybe I think it's too early for him to actually get a place at the Olympics, but it's good credit to him for the way he's been performing with his three clean sheets so far. And generally speaking, I don't think there's anything surprising in those. I don't think there is any bolter that's come into that squad, so yeah, good luck to them to try and cut that team down into 18, because as we know, it's a very difficult job.
Yes, we do, with first-hand experience. And yes, the Kawasaki Swiss Army knife, Reo Hatate, was named as a defender in this 27-man under-24 squad. So, don't envy Mr. Moriyasu, but we've done it ourselves. So if he's after any advice, we're well and truly here to help Mr. Moriyasu. All right, so we will leave it there, and obviously there are still two full rounds of J1 to play before these national team fixtures come around. But we just did want to mention as they loom on the horizon, and of course Friday's World Cup qualifier will be played in before our next episode. All right, so I think we'll leave it there, Sam. Great to catch up with Ryan in part one, and of course with you as well after another bumper J1 weekend. Looking forward to what Wednesday serves up, and we'll catch up again next week.
Yeah, thanks. I look forward to speaking to you again next week.
All right, then. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Ryan Steele for his time in part one of this episode. We'd like to thank Johnny, Akakichino 11, Tokyo Fox, Daniel, Luke, and Gabrielle for their questions via Patreon, and indeed all of our patrons for their ongoing support at patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, of course, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 17. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.